Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 4th of September, these are our main stories. Hong Kong's leader holds out an olive branch to protesters, but is it too little, too late? Britain's House of Commons votes later on an opposition bill that would force the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to ask the EU for a further Brexit delay. And there's an outcry in India over new traffic penalties, with one rickshaw driver fined nearly 40 times his day's earnings. Also in this podcast, while Hurricane Dorian has finally moved away from the Bahamas, the destruction is described as catastrophic.
They need every piece of help they can get. It's devastating. It's heartbreaking when you look and see the initial videos that are coming out of there. We will need the world to help us with this one.
And a local law forcing beggars to buy permits provokes reaction across Sweden.
I think it's insane to forbid people to beg if they're poor.
It's a very smart idea. They intrude your privacy.
That's all coming up, but we begin in Hong Kong, where its leader, Carrie Lam, has announced she'll withdraw the controversial extradition bill, which ignited the street demonstrations which have been taking place there for the last 3 months. The government had argued the bill would prevent Hong Kong from being used as a safe haven by criminals, but critics said it would expose people to China's justice system and erode the territory's judicial independence. In a televised message, Carrie Lam said that ending the disruption was her top priority.
Irrespective of our grievances or the depth of this contentment towards the government, we cannot agree or accept that violence is a solution to our problems. Our foremost priority now is to end violence, to safeguard the rule of law, and to restore order and safety in society.
Our correspondent Stephen McDonald is in Hong Kong.
It seems remarkable that it's taken 3 months for this bill to be withdrawn, given that this proposal for people to be sent to mainland Chinese courts controlled by the Communist Party, given that this was what sparked this crisis in the first place. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were taken to the streets at the beginning of June, and the government ignored this, said there was no need to adhere to the demands of the protesters. You fast forward to now and we're getting these weekly violent clashes in the streets in Hong Kong. And finally, this humiliating backdown for Carrie Lam's government and also for Beijing for that matter, because many here believe that really it's the central government calling the shots, that she didn't have the authority to do this without Beijing's consent. And I think it probably just shows that they're running out of ideas to try and kill this increasingly violent rebellion here. And the easiest thing for them to do has been to withdraw that bill. I mean, it was a sort of face-saving option to not withdraw the bill after the government publicly declared that it was effectively politically dead anyway. But now the problem is it's taken them so long to do it. The protesters have all these other demands. They want an inquiry into the police collusion with organised crime. They want universal suffrage. The question is what proportion of the protest movement will keep heading to the barricades, if you like, now that this bill has been officially withdrawn.
Yes, that's right, because will this be enough for the protesters now?
I think it might be enough for some, but not many others. There could be, especially in the broader peaceful wing of this movement, you know, the many hundreds of thousands of people who initially took to the streets, they'll say, well, that was our original concern. We've won on that one. Maybe that's enough to sort of start taking it easy. The problem, though, are the tens of thousands of radicalized, mainly young activists who want something more now. And I don't think they'll back down unless they get, well, their other demands as well.
Stephen McDonald in Hong Kong. It was angry, it was emotive, and in many respects, it felt like a general election campaign was already underway. Boris Johnson's first Prime Minister's questions was absolutely in keeping with this wild week in Westminster. After kicking 21 rebels out of his party yesterday, Boris Johnson faces another key day in the battle over Brexit, with MPs set to vote later on delaying further the country's departure from the European Union. Here's Mr. Johnson taking questions from the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn.
If the Prime Minister does to the country what he's done to his party in the past 24 hours, I think a lot of people have a great deal to fear from his incompetence, his vacillation, and his refusal to publish known facts that are known to him about the effects of a no-deal Brexit.
Mr. Speaker, I really don't see how, with a straight face, the Right Honourable Gentleman can accuse anybody of being unwilling to stand up to scrutiny when he will not agree, to submit his surrender bill to the verdict of the people in an election. He's frightened.
Well, our political correspondent Rob Watson was listening to proceedings from Westminster.
I can tell you that the verdict here at Westminster is that that has to be one of the most calamitous hours and calamitous Prime Minister's questions for a Prime Minister that anyone can remember in a very long time, because the thought had always been that Mr. Johnson, a sort of witty former newspaper columnist, would wipe the floor with Jeremy Corbyn, who often struggles in Parliament, but it did not work out that way at all. And beyond the exchanges that we just heard there, and you also heard Mr. Johnson being attacked, his truthfulness, his trustworthiness being attacked by MPs from his own side, the rebels from last night. And of course, there was an extraordinary moment in the House of Commons where an opposition MP was applauded, which is absolutely extraordinary in the House of Commons, after accusing Mr. Johnson of being a racist for things that he'd written in his previous life as a newspaper columnist. I mean, one can only say, I suppose, from Mr. Johnson's point of view, that he will just hope that all the public get from that exchange, all they get from this first Prime Minister's question, is Mr. Johnson's contention that, look, if there's going to be a general election, it'll be getting on with Brexit with me, Boris Johnson, or dither and delay from that old lefty, as he would call him, Jeremy Corbyn.
Mm. Well, most people think the UK is on a path to a general election with Brexit at its heart. The battle lines, are they already there, out there, drawn out and clear?
Yes, I mean, on this question of a general election, I don't think anyone doubts, not a single MP would doubt that there's going to be a general election soon. I mean, the precise date we're not so sure about. Will it be October the 15th, or will it be shortly after a delayed, postponed Brexit date on 31st of October? But I think what is already extremely clear is what this election will be about. It'll be Jeremy Corbyn saying, look, do you really want Donald Trump's best friend, the sort of right-wing nut job, as he's going to call him, Boris Johnson, and all those on the right of the Conservative Party, with a calamitous no-deal Brexit that they're so frightened the government won't publish any of its figures, any of its reports into what might happen in a no-deal, as against Boris Johnson saying, look, if you really want to get on with Brexit, with or without a deal, preferably with a deal, you'll vote for me. We can see that election now. All we don't know, Emilio, is the date.
Rob Watson. Hurricane Dorian did so much damage to the islands of the Bahamas because of its intensity and slow speed. At one point, the hurricane was stationary while winds of hundreds of kilometers per hour laid waste to the land below. How much damage is only now beginning to be seen? The number of dead has risen to 7, and there's little hope that is the final number. Speaking from the Bahamian capital, Nassau, Prime Minister Hubert Minnis gave an update on the number of casualties.
Let me talk about our initial assessment of Abaco. 5 deaths are confirmed. There may be additional deaths that we can expect. Of the 25 individuals that were transported to New Providence, 2 has already succumbed. That would take the number of deaths to 7. And again, I want to assure and inform the Bahamian population that we can expect more deaths.
Well, Clint Watson is a journalist from Eyewitness News. Speaking from Nassau, he told my colleague Dan Damon more about the search and rescue mission.
In a matter of hours will be the first main opportunity for rescue and recovery mission that the country will have. Now this hurricane has left the country. It means that rescuers can get into areas like Freeport and into areas like Abaco to see the damage, what it is that's there. Yesterday, Prime Minister was able to do a flyover to see the level of damage on the island and saw that it was vast. So they, no doubt, emergency responders will be going in more specifically to those areas to see whether there are people who are trapped, to see whether there are people who need additional medical attention. Already they've been moving people out to the capital, the Coast Guard, persons who needed immediate medical attention.
And the images I saw showed everything flattened.
That's exactly the image. The image is everything flattened. It's that way in every corner. It's that way for every major town or city. It's just pure devastation. It's unbelievable what 200 miles per hour winds have done to strong communities. I keep referring to Abaco because Abaco's economy was so strong. They were doing so well and contributing to the country. The economy really was very healthy. And now it's all gone, absolutely gone.
The medical help that's needed for those who have been injured, who are being taken to the hospitals, that's available, is it? Or is outside help requested too?
We're expecting people to come from everywhere. It's just that much work that has to be done, that much people that needs assistance. Remember now, these people have not eaten in days, so they haven't had food, they haven't had water, and so there is a great need to give them critical things first to just stabilize them before you can actually be able to assist in any other capacity. It's a matter that gets to them critical aid that they've been missing, particularly those in Grand Bahama who have either been stuck in roofs or stuck in water for hours. It's now critically to get the assistance that they need first to stabilize them.
The Bahamas have been through this kind of weather before, maybe not as severe and not so long over the islands, but how long does the rebuilding process take, or is it too early to talk about that?
It's not too early to talk about it. As a matter of fact, it's always a good time to have that conversation because it's reality what it is. And what we are facing really is a new day. We will no longer know these islands as what we know them for now. They will have to rebuild complete cities, and they will look different. You're starting over from scratch. But what one assessor said today gripped me. He says, this is the perfect opportunity to get it right this time. And what he means by that simply is, in 2019, 2020, there are better ways to build these cities that are on the coastlines to ensure that they withstand storms.
But it's the right place to do that, is it? Or is the weather now so threatening with more hurricanes, stronger hurricanes expected, that perhaps part of the island, anyway, should not be rebuilt?
That's exactly the conversation. You hit the nail on the head. Do we rebuild in the same location? Or do we now create a new city somewhere else where it's safer? Those are the conversations that ought to honestly be had because it makes a difference. Or we'll find ourselves here again next year or even later this month, and could be facing the same thing. This is only September. This is the beginning of the busy season in the hurricane season. Hurricane season is not even over. There could be a possibility of another storm within this season. So these are the conversations that we must have. Do we continually rebuild and rebuild the same place the same way and suffer destruction and have to rebuild again, or do we get smarter so that we don't keep having to start over?
Journalist Clint Watson speaking there from Nassau. Reprisal attacks have taken place in Nigeria in response to the violence aimed at foreign-owned businesses in South Africa, where at least 5 people were killed. The South African-owned mobile phone company MTN has closed shops and service centers across Nigeria after some had been attacked. Earlier, the Zambian foreign minister called on the South African government to bring an end to the attacks. Our correspondent in Johannesburg, Milton Nkosi, explained what started this surge of violence in South Africa.
This violence has been start and go over the years, beginning back in 2008. So South Africans who are facing a very tough economic outlook here feel that immigrants coming from other parts of the African continent come here to take their job opportunities. And remember that unemployment in South Africa stands at nearly 28%. And amongst the people between 18 and 34 years of age, it is even higher at about 54%. So there is pressure on the lower end unskilled labor in South Africa. And the immigrants who come in, that's where they take up those jobs. So the tension between immigrants and locals has been there. And immigration is at the center of the start of this sort of violence.
And Milton, we've mentioned now that Zambia and Ethiopia have joined Nigeria in condemning this violence. How will this affect relations across the continent?
Well, this has really created tensions across the continent. We know that a Zambian football match was supposed to be held between Zambia and South Africa on Saturday. That has been cancelled. It was supposed to be held in Lusaka. And the Zambian Football Association officials said that they just don't want to take any risks for visiting South Africans. So South Africa is currently in talks with Madagascar to continue with that friendly game. And then there were reports this morning that some heads of state from Africa were cancelling their visit to the World Economic Forum for Africa, which is underway in Cape Town because of xenophobia. But that has now been denied by the officials who are running the forum in Cape Town. Elsie Kanza, who is the head of the World Economic Forum Africa, said that she was surprised to hear of the news about boycott.
Milton Nkosi. Now, just a little reminder about one of the BBC World Service's newest podcasts. Music Life is a podcast that puts four top musicians together in a room and gets them talking. And what we end up with is a series of fascinating insights into the lives and minds of our music stars, from the insecurities and anxieties that both stalk them and feed their music to tales of life on the road. Music Life is your Access All Areas pass to the lives of musicians. Just search for Music Life wherever you found this podcast. But still to come in this podcast, we'll hear why this musician is trying to make amends. More on Justin Bieber's emotional confessional later. If a police officer gave you a ticket fining you 40 times your day's earnings, well, firstly, you might be deterred from driving badly. But you might also be outraged at what could be described as a disproportionate penalty. That's what's happened in the Indian capital, Delhi, and it's part of a new government policy. Our South Asia editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan, told me there's been a strong reaction.
This has caused a huge outrage on social media in India. Normally, auto rickshaw drivers, they would earn about $10 to $12 or, you know, even less than that on an average day. And then he was given a ticket first for allegedly jumping a red light. And then when they checked whether he had a license and other papers, like many other auto rickshaw drivers, he said, I had everything at home. So the fines added up. It has come to, you know, nearly 40 times his average earning a day. And it's happening, you know, for a couple of other people. A scooter user was saying my fine was almost double the cost of my vehicle. So the new regulations were introduced only a couple of days ago from the beginning of September. The whole idea was to reduce traffic violations because it's causing a lot of accidents. People are dying on the roads. And the government was debating this in parliament and then they announced it. Only thing is whether the campaign was taken to the people, ordinary road users. And that's why people are suddenly shocked by these huge and hefty fines.
So what's the philosophy behind the fine And will it really improve things?
It will act as a deterrent. That's what the government hopes. I'll give you an example. I have the list in front of me. For example, driving without a license, which many people do in India, which was $7 before, and now it is $70. Also, overspeeding, again, it has gone up by like five times. But what India has done, you know, the traffic has improved, or the roads have been built, new highways have been built. All the modern cars, powerful bikes have come into India. All these things have increased the amount of traffic on the roads. But what is not happening is teaching people how to follow lane discipline, how to drive on the roads, because everyone is taking, overtaking everyone. And the tailgating is very, very common, because if you give some space, as my driver was telling me last month, that, you know, the auto rickshaw, someone will come in between. So don't give any gap. So that kind of close tailgating. So people are not used to following rules, and that is what is causing many of these accidents.
I'm Barasan Ethirajan. An investigation has been launched into a fatal boat fire off the coast of Santa Barbara in California on Monday. At least 20 people are known to have died. 14 others are still missing. National Transport Safety Board member Jennifer Homendi spoke to journalists about the investigation.
We expect to be on scene about 7 to 10 days. During that time, our investigators will be collecting the perishable evidence. We will not be determining the cause of the fire while on scene. That comes later in the investigative process. Nor will we speculate on the cause. However, we will provide factual information as it becomes available. I am 100% confident that our investigators will determine the cause of this fire, why it occurred, how it occurred, and what is needed to prevent it from happening again.
Jennifer Homendi of the U.S. National Transport Safety Board. A small Swedish city has become the first place in the country to force street beggars to buy a license, costing around $25. Eskilstuna, about 100 kilometers west of Stockholm, introduced the paperwork last month. City councillors say the policy is designed to encourage beggars to register so they can get help, but critics argue it's increasing tensions. Maddie Savage went to find out how it's working so far.
Breakfast is being served at this non-profit day centre for vulnerable people in Eskilstuna. The homeless and others in need can pop in to have a warm shower or leftover food donated by local businesses.
My name is Therese Lekander and I work here.
What have they been saying to you about these new permits?
They are worried and sad how to get it, but when they get it, they were very pleased and glad for it. It's the last chance to get food in the table and children to school. They have no education. They cannot read. They cannot spell their names.
Also visiting the day centre this morning is Thomas Lindress, who's a regional director for the charity.
In the start, people were quite generous, but after a while, people got more sceptics when they saw people always begging everywhere.
What do you think about having to ask this group to pay to beg?
I don't think it's the right way to go, but we will continue to help them in one way or another.
8 permits have been approved so far, proof that the new law hasn't put off beggars completely. But staff are worried that the change is leading to an increase in tensions. Several beggars say locals have tried to force them off the streets, something only the police are entitled to do. Jimmy Jansson is a councillor for the largest party in the city, the centre-left Social Democrats, who brought in the change.
What's the alternative? We have a situation where thousands of people live in an alternative society away from the social welfare system. We can't see that it's reasonable to just sit year out and year in on our streets and beg for money.
In the longer term, he says he hopes the permits will help the council to keep a better track of the begging community and encourage locals to contribute in other ways.
If people can help with maybe a bed or food or an education or a simple job or something, instead of just accept that people have to beg.
A few hundred metres away from the council's offices, there's a free concert this afternoon, paid for by the municipality. I've been in the city about 5 hours now, and so far I haven't seen anyone begging on the street. And locals here seem to have mixed feelings about the new permits.
I think it's insane to forbid people to beg if they're poor.
It's a very smart idea. They intrude your privacy, makes you want to donate money to them, and it's not for a good cause.
No, I think it's good because I'm a little bit disturbed when they are sitting outside asking every day.
What's happening here in Eskilstuna is being closely watched by municipalities around the country and elsewhere in Europe. Some areas are mulling similar permits, while others are going even further and issuing local bans. That is putting Sweden's government under pressure to face the music and come up with a nationwide solution.
Maddie Savage reporting from Sweden. With record sales at an estimated 150 million, the Canadian singer Justin Bieber is one of the 21st century's most successful pop stars, but not, according to him, one of the happiest. He's published a lengthy note on social media confessing how fame drove him to become what he calls a shell of a person, abusing drugs and relationships. Jonathan Savage has more.
Justin Bieber has been world famous for about 10 of his 25 years, and his career path has been a well-worn one. Teen idol to tearaway. There was pretty much instant fame. This song, One Time, was a debut hit in his native Canada, the US, and later around the globe. By the time he was 16, Bieber had a platinum record, had appeared on American TV's most famous shows, and even sung for President Obama. In his Instagram post, Justin Bieber explains that he went from a 13-year-old boy from a small town to being praised left and right by the world. Everyone did everything for me, so I never even learned the fundamentals of responsibility. And the star confesses the consequence of that was that by 19 he was taking what he calls heavy drugs and abusing the relationships he was in. He was, in his words, resentful, disrespectful to women and angry. Bieber was arrested several times in 2014 with offences ranging from vandalism to driving under the influence of alcohol, a charge which was later reduced to driving without due care and attention. The point of Justin Bieber's post is to say that he's a changed man, that we should be aware of the fact that teenage brains aren't developed enough to cope with the pressures and prizes of fame. A long list of young celebrities, from Judy Garland to Lindsay Lohan, might agree. But for all his mistakes, Justin Bieber, at 25, has time to make amends. Is it too late now to say sorry? 'Cause
I'm missing more than just. Jonathan Savage reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.